Christ compels you! The power of Christ compels you!
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and it is Halloween week here on Talk is Jericho. And that means it's the annual tradition of lining up a couple of great, scary, horrific shows lined up for you, starting with today. Kevin Eustace returns to talk about the curse of fame. All the movies, musicians, songs that seem to be cursed by the devil. You hear all the creepy and even tragic stories that surround some of the people involved with movies like The Exorcist, The Omen, and Rosemary's Baby, all of them creepy. And the weird links between the Charles Manson murders, the Beatles, and Mia Farrow. You'll also hear why fans believe that everyone from Eric Clapton to John Lennon to Fleetwood Mac to the Allman Brothers Band are cursed as well, and why musicians might want to think twice before covering Robert Johnson's Crossroads. Kevin's also sharing info about John Lennon's strange connection and obsession with the number 9, what it means, what might have caused singer Harry Nilsson's London home to be cursed, all the other tragedies tied to Buddy Holly's plane crash, so many tragic, scary rock and roll stories. It's the curse of fame with Kevin Eustace coming up. And guess what's happening on Thursday? Winnipeggers are coming back to you live, 9 p.m. Eastern, on my Facebook channel and my YouTube channel. Special live Winnipeggers is also going to be happening on November 5th. But this week on the 28th, we're doing Halloween costumes. Rybo and Dave will be talking about all of their costumes they had. I don't know from when. Who knows? You never know what's going to happen on the Winnipeggers. If you didn't see last week's Imitations episode, it was our worst drawing episode yet, and it was one of our best. So go back and watch that on YouTube and my Facebook page. So do that now on my YouTube channel. All right, let the Halloween festivities begin on Talk is Jericho with the curse of fame.
The power of Christ compels you! The power of Christ compels you!
As we are around the Halloween season, I always like to have some Halloween-y type material. Last year, of course, we did Paranormal Beatles with Kevin Eustace, who's been on twice since then, Ned?
Yeah, we done Paranormal... Well, no, this is the second time since, so three times all in.
Yeah. We did Paranormal Beatles, we did rock and roll ghost stories type stuff, right? And then we did Mr. Crowley.
Yeah, Mr. Crowley, yeah.
That was the last one. And today you had a great idea of the curse of fame.
Yeah.
Which is, you had a great list of topics and ideas and thoughts. And how did you come up with this idea?
Well, as you know, like yourself, I do two podcasts. I do We Need to Talk About Ghosts and another one called The Dark Paranormal. But they're both like listener ghost stories. But anyone right. who's interested in ghost stories like we are or the paranormal, your interest doesn't just stop at ghost stories. You know, if you're interested in one, you're normally then interested in UFOs, cryptids, spiritualism and
exactly.
everything else. And I never really get a chance to talk about the other stuff because people just go, well, that's not about ghosts. Why is he banging on about that? So when I come onto your show, I get a chance to broaden my horizons a bit. So anytime I'm thinking of a show to come back on Talk is Jericho, I'm like, right, what can I do? Which you've really got an interest in. It's a bit different and give me a chance to do a bit of research and paint the walls.
Yeah. No, it's a great idea. And like I said, it's always awesome having you on specifically because of your topics, but also too, your accent is always great to hear on radio.
Scousers, yeah.
Scouser, yeah. So the curse of fame. So, I mean, I don't even know how you want to start on this, but it seems that there's always these stories associated with different films and you have films, musicians and songs.
Yeah.
Some of these I've heard, some I haven't. I have a couple of my own to toss in there with you.
Yeah, but it's normally how these conversations go. You normally throw, this is why I enjoy them so much, you normally throw something back in which I've normally not heard of, and it normally leaves me scrambling on my phone thinking, I've never even heard of that. What I need to try and find out what he's on about. But yeah, it does seem to be, like, you know, I said the curse of fame because that is the one thing that links your movies, your musicians, and your songs. It's everybody striving to get noticed, isn't it, at its essence, mm-hmm. really. But I thought, you know, everybody's heard a little bit. You've heard of everyone's mainly going to go on about poltergeist films and things like that, you know, and all that sort of carry on. So I thought if we do a few films, so I'm going to try and focus on The Exorcist, The Omen, Rosemary's Baby, and then move into music. And, you know, just see that it seems to be what may not be classed as a curse sometimes, just a series of serendipity or coincidences that are just really hard to nail down as just a coincidence. So I thought we'd start film-wise. You know, like The Exorcist for me is the one that puts the literal fear of God into me anytime that it's brought up or mm-hmm. anytime I watch it. And it was obviously, it came out in 74. It was based on a book by William Peter Blatty. So he based that on a real story about a guy, well, a boy, should I say, called Roland Doe, who his family were Lutheran, and the child started to show signs of possession. So they went and seen a Lutheran minister, and he said, I'll take him in, like, I'll look after him and see if this still goes on in a religious setting. And it went worse. It everything went ballistic. And he came back to the parents and said, I don't know what to tell you, but you go and see the Catholics. They know what to do. They deal with this sort of stuff. So Roland Doe went and had this, that's not his real name, obviously, but we don't know his real name. He went and had this exorcism, and it was written about, I think, in the Washington Post. And Peter Blatty was there and then said, I'm going to write a fictionalized version of this. And Roland then became Reagan from The Exorcist. Hmm. And then that's the film we know. And it's always struck me as a massive, it's very rarely, I think, that something manages to break through into culture, if you like. And The Exorcist manages to do that massively. I remember I went out with a girl once, for example, and suggested that we watch The Exorcist and Hers one night. And the mother would not allow the film to come into the house. It was on like VHS cassette. And she was like, no, it's not coming in. Because there was like, people have this sense that there's an evil attached even within the film. And I don't know, did you see, ever experience something similar, like in terms of your upbringing religious wise?
Well, I mean, it's something about for those types of movies always scare me the most, because to me, they could be true. I mean, obviously, you know, serial killers and masked, you know, murderers and that sort of thing, anybody, you know, that could happen as well. But when you're talking about The Omen and The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby, like if you have any type of religious knowledge or religious upbringing at all, you know that this stuff could be real. And so that's why even just the concept of The Exorcist is scary. And even to this day, like if you haven't seen that recently, anybody listening, watch it again. It's still fucking, it's just like The Omen. Like I watch The Omen yearly and it still creeps me out because it's just as relevant and just as scary today as it was in 1973.
Yeah, completely. I'm just certain these are the sorts of things where, I mean, I'll go on to it now so we're not, I'm not just waffling with you, but starting with The Exorcist, let's say, for example, maybe look at some of the like serendipities and synchronicities within there. The people who are working on the film, for example, so there was a sound effects guy who was very skeptical about the whole situation, but even he, his name was Marso Vercature, and even he said he felt like he was playing with something that he shouldn't be playing with. And they think he always felt like someone was watching him, and there was this sense of evil and being looked at on the set. But the best example of this sort of eeriness that goes within, and this is from the back of this tale, it seems to then dwell into the rest of these sort of films which dwell on Satan and the occult and stuff. And the guy who played Damien Karras, Jason Miller, he tells a story that when they were filming in Jesuit quarters, like an actual Jesuit training place, if you like. And he went to a restaurant nearby, and when he was in this restaurant after shooting one day, an old priest comes up to him and he opens his palm and puts in it a medallion of the Virgin Mary. And he says, do you know why I'm giving you this? And he says, no idea. And he says, have you ever heard about intervention? And Jason Miller says, no. And he says, well, it's a Gnostic concept from the 15th century, he says. But basic idea is, if you do anything about the devil, anything at all to reveal him as the trickster that he is, then he'll do whatever he can to try and stop you from unveiling him. And this medal will protect you from that intervention. So he's like, right, okay, bit weird, but thank you. And then they continue filming, and he goes, 3 days later, he's walking through the Jesuit quarters, and it's all, as you'd imagine, like catacombed and little sitting rooms off to the side, to the left and the right as you're walking down. And as he's walking down, in his peripheral vision, he catches something, and he's like, did I just, so he stops, goes back, and there's a casket laid out in this room. And when he goes in, looks in the casket, it's the priest that given him the medal 3 days before. And he just then dwells on this intervention, puts the literal fear of God into him, like, you know, with this idea of intervention, that anytime you try and expose the devil, he'll come after you and try and stop you. Because, of course, that whole, the greatest thing the devil's ever done is make people believe he didn't exist line, as we all know. So, yeah, so that's the key idea that seems to carry into all these films, this idea of intervention of an evil dark force trying to stop this fictional films, if you like, getting made, but because of what they may display about the evil one himself.
Well, it's interesting because as you were talking, I just Googled Exorcist movie curse, and there's a couple other ones here that we can discuss. Now, you said earlier about feeling weird even just having you, or the lady or wouldn't even allow you to bring the VHS into the house, right? So Billy Graham, the famous televangelist, said the actual film is cursed, that playing it through a projector was an invitation for demonic possession.
Wow. Yeah, you know? I can't believe that from the evangelical side of things, you know, and the thing is, a lot of this, you know, I should have said at the start, everybody listening needs to take all of this with a massive bag of salt, because, you know, a lot of it you'll think, people will think, no, no way. Some of it you'll think, that's too freaky and coincidental. But if you let it play in your mind, you know, it's not necessarily might be the devil that'll get you, but it'll be your own mental health that'll get you, I think. I think that's why people are quite against Ouija boards and stuff, you know. But
well, it's just like even now, you know, in the pandemic, like if you sneeze or if you have like a slight sore throat just from being a human being, suddenly it's like, oh my gosh, like, you know, do I have it? Am I infected? You know, am I possessed?
Yeah, well, that's totally right. Exactly. I mean, there was some of the like little weird bits obviously attached to the film where you could argue the intervention starts. So there were a number of deaths associated with the film. Jack McGowan, who played Beck Dennings, the director within the film, he finished filming and dropped dead a couple of weeks later of like complications, strangely, with the flu.
Wow.
Quite an apt time, yeah. So did the woman who played Karis's mother, Vasilaki Mariola, she died before filming finished. I mean, she was quite elderly. So and there's all these things you can look at both ways, you know.
Sure.
Another guy, there was a night watchman who was looking after the set, and he was only in his early 30s. He dropped dead of a heart attack while he was looking after the set. And then the set caught fire and everything burnt down. It delayed filming by about 6 weeks, except for the room where Reagan was in. That stayed fine.
Of course.
The last sort of like little strange one, I mean, The Omen's got loads. I can't wait to crack on with that. But the last little strange one, Exorcist-wise, as a little side note, is when the premiere took place in Rome for the Italian premiere. Obviously, Rome's like arguably the most religious city, or one of them, in the world. The theatre where they were showing the film, it was next to a 400-year-old church. Nice day, lovely day. And as the day went on with the film due to play in the night, a storm rolled in out of nowhere. No, hadn't been predicted. It just rolled in. Massive thunderstorm, and lightning struck the crucifix on top of that church, causing it to fall into the piazza below and narrowly miss everyone who was queuing to get in for the film. So it's either the best publicity stunt of all time, or it's just a coincidence, but you know.
Well, and the last one, it says the actress that played Pazuzu, the voice, the demon, Mercedes McCambridge, was the victim of a horrific tragedy when her son murdered his wife and children before taking his own life.
No way. See, I didn't find that one.
Yeah. So once again, coincidence or not, but
yeah,
it's still pretty, you know, pretty creepy when you consider all of these things, right?
Yeah.
Look at me, Damien. It's all.
Well, let's move on to one of my favorites, which is The Omen. And like I mentioned to you earlier, I watch The Omen and The Omen 2 yearly. My 666th episode of this show was a watch along with Kevin Smith for Omen 2. So
amazing.
We are totally obsessed with this. And I actually just texted him and said, I'm doing this podcast and I'm about ready to hit The Omen right now. So what do you got, dude?
Well, here's what I've got, and you've probably got more than this. But again, so I mean, the first thing that it is kind of funny, but like, amazing marketing for The Omen. They released it on the sixth day of the sixth month, 1976. So that's just perfect. That's a poster right there, isn't it? That's amazing.
Of course.
Now, Bob Munger, who created The Omen, he got the idea driving through, I think it was LA, and he thought, what if the Antichrist's already here? What if he's like walking around as a little boy? He took it to a friend of his who knows like people in the industry. They said, we can make a film of this. And he sat down with the group that he initially got together and was like, I've got a quote there. He says, the devil's best trick, as is known, is to work invisibly. And if we take that cloak off and put him front of center, he's going to not want to let that to happen. So we need to be very careful, which again is harking back to the intervention idea that, you know, he's going to try and put a stop to things. The producer, Harvey Bernard, he wore a silver crucifix right the way through production. And he said that even after the film, he genuinely believed that the devil didn't want that film to be made. He said he felt like he wasn't sleeping alone of a night when he was in the UK. And again, it's this intervention topic. But they struggled to get a film company on board initially, apparently, because he was a no one and he just had an idea and a few good producers and stuff. And then they needed a huge star. And then Gregory Peck signed up. He got read the role for Robert Thorne. Mm-hmm. And they gave it credibility. So then they managed to get on board. I think it was with 20th Century Fox, come on board with it. And now he played Robert Thorne, who was Damien's father. And 3 months before they were due to start, Gregory Peck's son, Jonathan, at 31 years old, took a gun and blew his brains out, committed suicide, Gregory Peck's son, after he'd signed up for the film. He decided he was still going to go ahead with the film, so he flew to London. Gregory Peck did. His plane was struck by lightning on the way to London, which he took as a bit of a bad omen. And then one of the producers, Mace Newfield, he had a flight book for the week after and had read that Gregory Peck's plane had been hit by lightning. But he thought, no, I'll be all right. Lightning doesn't strike twice. But it did. And his plane got struck by lightning on the way over too. This is like one of the certain stories about the omen, sorry, that when I read them, and I've just got a shiver knowing I'm about to tell you this part of it. But one of the scariest ones for me is the director, which I think was it Richard Donner? Yeah, Richard Donner.
Yeah.
He wanted shots over London. At some point in the film, like if a plane flying over London, he wanted to shoot down onto London City. So they rented a cheap plane called a Hawker from a local airfield. And they got a call on the day that they were due to set out to film from that plane, from the airfield, to say that the airfield had got a better deal for that plane. And if they gave up the slot, he'd give them a bigger discount for the next time that they flew. So begrudgingly, Donner agreed for that. And it was a last minute switch. Anyway, that plane takes off an hour later. As it's about to leave the runway, a flock of birds fly into the engines.
Oh, wow.
It doesn't make it off the runway, comes back down onto the runway, smashes through the railings at the end of the runway and goes onto the main road where it has a head-on collision with a car. Now,
what?
Yeah. Now, this is like where you think, well, hold on, there's coincidences and then there's this. Inside that car, everybody died with the collision, but inside that car was the wife and children of the airfield's pilot.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yes, that's a coincidence. You could argue, well, that's a horrible, you know, people have died. It's a horrible, horrific coincidence. But it's a bit beyond the realms of just coincidence for me. Like when I do get a shiver when I reread that.
There's two others that are sticking out for me. Have you heard the one about the monkeys when Lee Remick and Damien are at the drive-through jungle?
Yeah, and they go berserk. So they were filming in the safari park, wasn't they? And apparently, yeah, to get the monkeys to go berserk for the scene, they took one of the young monkeys and put it in the car with them. So it would make the monkeys go berserk. But apparently they went absolutely, like, supernaturally berserk, if you like, and started just dismantling this car. And then they had to speed off. Obviously, like you would at a safari park if your car's trying to be dismantled by monkeys. But in that safari park, interestingly enough, they were filming also another scene where it ended up getting cut out, where they were walking around looking at lions and tigers. And the guy who was in the safari park, who was helping them like be their liaison, at one point whilst they were there, he went over to deal with a tiger that they were going to be dealing with. And like he's done every day, he puts his head through the cage. Sounds stupid now, and you know where this is going. But anyway, he puts his head through the cage to like say hello to the tiger. And the tiger, who's meant to be nice all the way through its life up to this point, snaps and crushes his skull and just kills him instantly. So they get rid of that. I mean, there's been a few animal ones as well. There's also, you know, the Rottweiler scene in the graveyard.
Well, just let me finish off your story. Just to finish off your story about the tiger. That was the trainer responsible for the baboons that attacked Damien.
Really? The same guy?
Yes, and he died the day after filming that scene with the tiger.
Oh, my God.
So there you go.
Oh, my God. That's just it is beyond coincidence. I know, say, take it with a pinch of salt, but bloody hell.
So were you talking about the Rottweilers?
Oh, sorry, yeah. So the stuntman who was in the Rottweiler scene, you know, where the Rottweilers go crazy. Mm-hmm. The stuntman who was acting with that in that one, I got a strange feeling, and he said, you know what, I'm not comfortable. I want to double up what I'd normally have for this Rottweiler scene. So he got doubled up on his padding, and he still wasn't happy. He said, no, you know what, also put like a sheet of steel in the arms. He's like, because I don't feel good. So they did. He doubled it up, put a sheet of steel in, went through the scene because he then thought he'd be safe. And the performing dogs, who were experienced performing dogs, managed to bite through. They didn't let go. They all went berserk again. They bit through the steel and through the padding. And he was hospitalized with bites. And this is a guy who's literally would have went in with the one sheet of padding, assuming he was fine because he's done it before. And he was mauled, absolutely mauled.
Wow.
There's people then do try and drag it away and say there's the whole devil and the black dog situation. Is that what's going on? But I don't think it is.
What have you done to him, you maniac?
Satan is his father, not Guy. He came up from hell and begat a son of mortal woman.
Hail Satan!
Hail Satan!
Satan is his father, and his name is Adrian. He shall overthrow the mighty and lay waste their temples. He shall redeem the despised and wreak vengeance in the name of the burned and the tortured. Hail Adrian!
Hail Adrian!
Hail Satan! Hail Satan!
He chose you out of all the world, out of all the women in the whole world. He chose you. He arranged things because he wanted you to be the mother of his only living son.
His power is stronger than stronger. His might shall last longer than longer.
Hail Satan!
Let's go to the creepiest one of all. How about the decapitation? Have you heard that one?
Well, yeah, this is kind of like, it's next level really, isn't it? In the decapitation scene, as people will know if they've seen the film, you've got the character Keith Jennings is like doing some work, and he's got a van next to him, and there's a pane of glass on the van, and it's supernaturally the handbrake comes off and it rolls back. The sheet of glass flies off the back and decapitates him. And the guy who was responsible for that special effect part was called John Richardson. And he done that, and everyone said, amazing, that looks dead good. A year after the film came out, he's working on another film in Holland, and he's driving down the street with his PA, I think, in the middle of the night, Liz Moore. And they're just driving away. Anyway, they get involved in a head-on crash, a horrific crash. And the force of the crash forces the front tire through the car and decapitates Liz Moore. And he's sent flying from the car. And when he wakes up, because he's like being knocked out and he's like got broken limbs and stuff. And when he wakes up at the side of the road, when he opens his eyes, the first thing that he sees is a sign on the side of the road that says 66.6 kilometers to the nearest town. And that nearest town, although it's spelled with two M's, is called Omen, which is just...
That's insane, man.
It really is, isn't it? It's next level, like. It's just absolutely beyond. There was another one that I stumbled upon, like sort of last minute. Wow. There was a guy called Alf Joint who was the stuntman. You know the scene where Mrs. Thorne, is it Catherine Thorne, is thrown from the hospital window and she lands on the ambulance? Well, the guy who done that stunt is called Alf Joint, and he'd done a similar stunt a year later. He was working on Bridge Too Far. And in this particular scene, he had to do a very similar stunt where he jumps from a roof into the airbags on the floor. He's done it hundreds of times before. And on the video footage of when he does this jump, he seems to twist awkwardly at the last minute. He misses the airbags and he's rushed to hospital in intensive care. And when he comes to, he's really angry. And the first thing you want to know is who pushed him, because he said he's done that stunt over and over again and he knows what he's doing with it. But he says he was pushed at the last minute. And they show him the footage and like the nearest person to you is 10 meters away. And it just shook him because they can see him physically be pushed as well. And then there's also the intervention part, like he'll try and stop what you're doing. There's loads during the filming part, which is just amazing. It's like, because all the crew and the cast got freaked out with everything that was going on. So they're like, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. So much so that, you know, the infamous scene where Lee Remick is, Damien goes past on the tricycle and knocks her off the stool and she falls over the balcony. That was meant to be filmed with like a free falling harness. And she said, with everything that's going on, I don't want to do that because I don't think it'll work and I think I'll die. And so much so that they actually didn't do that. When when you look at it again, they actually put the floor on the wall and put her on a standing trolley and just asked her to spin round towards the wall. So,
oh, wow.
So they reshot it because she was so fearful of doing it. And you think, right, well, that's a sign that where everyone's heads at if they're having to reshoot scenes based on people not wanting to do it.
Right. And I remember that scene. It looks very strange of like this kind of
circling. Yeah. Yeah. And that's why they added in the flowers dropping. So they still had the sense of depth of when the flowers go first.
Right.
But again, just to the two sort of last things in the intervention category, which again, freaked me out. When all the crew from the LA, they were staying in the Hilton in London, And they all said, should we go and have a walk about and see what's going on? So they all met in the lobby in the Hilton. They walk out of the lobby onto the road, and there's an explosion in the lobby. And the IRA had just let off a bomb in the lobby of the Hilton. Jeez. And they just missed it by a series of minutes. So Gregory Peck, with all this going on, says, you just all need to calm down. It's kind of comical, really. Like, you just think, you just stop, wouldn't you? He's like, you don't need to calm down. I'm going to relax you all and take you for a nice meal at a seafood restaurant. It's my favorite restaurant. Just come along. It'll be dead good. So everyone goes, right, okay. So he books the table for 7:30. And at 7:10, the IRA have planted another bomb in the restaurant. And they miss it again by like 20 minutes. It's like, honest to God, you just say, I'm not doing that film and I'm not doing any sequels. No way.
Oh, man. Well, let's go to the other one. That's each one I'm Googling says the most cursed movie ever.
Exactly.
First, it said that Exorcist, then it said about The Omen. And now, of course, talk about Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, Rosemary's Baby. It's an interesting one, Rosemary's Baby, because it's the first of the three. And I didn't know that until I started doing this. I've seen them all, but I couldn't really put a chronology on them. But Rosemary's Baby was 1968. It was obviously written and directed by Roman Polanski. Now, it's the birth of these Antichrist films, you know, like if somebody's born and he is the Antichrist, or in this case, she's pregnant with the Antichrist and Satan's child himself. Now, this is not really as good as the other two in terms of, I think anyway, in terms of all the intervention stuff, but it does allow a nice little segue into the music side of things, I think. So the guy, one of the main spooky things around it, the guy who was the producer for it was a guy called William Castle. And he hated the film. Mm. Apparently, even after the film was going up for awards, he'd never leave the house to go to an award show. He said that he was afraid that with this film, he was quoted as saying, with this film, I have unleashed evil upon the world. He got death threats and hate mail from groups of witches across the states, putting curses on him, spells on him. It drove his mental health into a bit of a decline. And then he ended up having really bad troubles with his kidneys. So much so he was hospitalized. And when he was in hospital, he then started to see things that weren't there. And nurses would report, he would shout things like, Rosemary, put down the knife. And he was seeing himself being attacked by characters from the film, which you could argue is just someone's mental health declining. But, you know, it is within the world we're talking.
Still, yeah.
There was another thing such as like one of Rosemary's friends in the film falls into a coma and then dies as he's about to tell us something about the cult that's within the building. Now, the guy who'd done the music for the film was a guy called Christoph Commodore, and he fell off a cliff when he was 37, a year after the film was out, and went into a coma for the exact same amount of time as the character in the film and then died off the back of that. So there's all strange, they're the sort of strange things up till the story that we all know, which is, of course,
right,
Roman Polanski's wife, Sharon Tate. Interestingly, Sharon Tate actually tried for the role of Rosemary, but Mia Farrow, Farrow got the role. And Tate's actually in the film in a party scene. She's in the background moving around as an extra. Mm. Now, we all probably know Tate, pregnant with Polanski's child, goes to a party in CeeLo Drive and is set upon by the Manson family. She's stabbed multiple times, kills her and her unborn child. And now Polanski says at the time he seen her, when she said she was going to this party, it was the last time that he seen her. And he said he just got a feeling come over him like a heavy cloud that it was the last time he was going to see her. He said he couldn't explain it. He just knew he would never see her again. Now, this is where it gets, it's not a cheeky segue, but it's a good segue, really, because this then ties into the Beatles kind of idea. We all know there's an apparent Beatles-related curse involved with the Manson family and all that carry on. But there's also little links which I didn't know only through researching this for this show. And I was like, God, that's interesting, in my opinion, anyway. And it was, there's an apparent Beatles-related tie into the curse because Mia Farrow, as we say, she got the role over Sharon Tate. But the year before the film, she had a sabbatical in India and she stayed and hung out whilst there with the Beatles, who were working on songs for the White Album. The White Album being the album that went on to inspire Charles Manson to then go and murder everyone to the point where his family, if you like, would use the victim's blood to write things like Helter Skelter, Piggies, and titles from other Beatles tracks from the White Album on the walls in blood.
Right.
And it's just interesting that, you know, for me, it's interesting. Mia Farrow was in India with the Beatles whilst they're writing the songs that somebody would hear back in the States that would inspire them to go and kill the person who tried out for the role that Mia Farrow got. You know, it's just all a little bit.
Yeah, and also the fact that Dear Prudence, Prudence is Mia Farrow's sister. Prudence.
I did not know that.
That's you what just that song is about.
A shiver right down my spine. Really? Is that? Is it? Oh, my
yeah,
God.
Anything Beatles, man. No, but that's really interesting when you point that out. Yeah, Mia Farrow was starring in the movie. She was with the Maharishi, yeah, with the Beatles as they were writing the song. That
inspired Charles Manson, yeah, to go and, wow, kill the person who failed to get that role. But obviously the one that we all definitely know about the Beatles and Rosemary's Baby is that the Bramford building where Rosemary's Baby's filmed is in fact the Dakota building where John Lennon was shot.
Oh, wow.
So there's another time with the Beatles there. That's the whole thing was filmed within the Dakota, and the outside scenes that they filmed, that's the Dakota building where obviously John Lennon was killed. And that, to be honest, Chris, that's me doing a not so subtle segue into John Lennon.
And let me just, before you get started, yes, it was definitely Prudence Farrow, Mia's 19-year-old
oh my
sister,
God,
who was there at the time. Yeah, she was in India with her sister, and she had locked herself away in her hut at the ashram in Rishikesh, where she and her sister were studying transcendental meditation.
Oh, my God.
They're starting to worry about her state of mind. She got an attack of the horrors, paranoia, identity crisis. She was going crazy, and so John wrote that song to make her feel better. Dear Prudence, won't you come
on? Oh, my. You know what? Seriously, as soon as we finish, I'm going to look at all that, and I'll probably send you a text saying, listen, no, I've lost my mind now. Bloody hell.
Okay, I told you, man. I can't believe you didn't know that. Let's talk about John and you, where were you saying the number, John and the number nine,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the number nine. So it's, you know, again, this is more of a string. All the music ones seem to be more of a string of synchronicities that could be perceived as a curse, to be honest.
Right.
The Lennon and the number nine, it started off when I looked at that, I thought, there's a few bits. But the more I looked into it, it was like, oh my God, no, there's loads. So Lennon and the number nine then. So it could just be coincidence, but he was born the 9th of October. So that's one. There's his first number nine. His first house was number 9 Newcastle Road. They first played the Cavern on the 9th of February 1961. They met Brian Epstein on the 9th of November 1961. They broke stateside on the 9th of February 64 with the Ed Sullivan Show. They played together for 9 years. He obviously recorded songs Revolution number 9, number 9 Dream, One After 909. His son Sean was born on the same day as him, the 9th of October. And although it was the 8th of December when he was killed in New York, in Liverpool, his hometown, it was the 9th due to the time difference. And when he was shot, he was rushed to Roosevelt Hospital in Manhattan, which is on 9th Avenue. Now, he's actually been quoted. I didn't know that he was aware of this. I thought it was something that we'd all put together as Beatles fans throughout the world after his death. But he knew about this, and he apparently was quoted as saying, 9 is a number that follows me around. Numerologically, whatever it is. Yeah. He says, I'm a 6 or a 3. He says, but it's all part of 9. Now, one thing that I was looking on, one of the deepest, darkest recesses of the internet in terms of Beatles and conspiracy theories. So again, this is a massive pinch of salt, but it is interesting. And I've mentioned this previously on the Beatles Paranormal show that we've done. There's a belief or a rumor that John Lennon, on his 20th birthday, which would be the 9th of October, made a pact with the devil on a bridge in Mossley Hill, which is a borough in Liverpool, for 20 years of fame. So he sold his soul for the devil. 20 years of fame. He died when he was 40. Now, on this conspiracy website, it was a really good, it had me believing for a bit. It said the song Number 9 Dream that he done may be him referencing that meeting with the devil. It says because it was from the Walls and Bridges album, which was his 9th non-Beatles album. The sleeve has a painting of John, that John done when he was 9, of a footballer with a number 9 on his back. The single Number 9 Dream, when it was released, it peaked at number 9 in the US. But lyrically, it says it's the lyrics of Number 9 Dream, which is said to be a nod to this deal with the devil, because in the lyrics of it, it says, was it just a dream? It seemed so real to me. Took a walk down the street, thought I heard someone whispering my name. Saw two spirits dancing, so strange. Was magic in the air. I believe, yes, I believe. More I cannot say. I could feel the music touching my soul. The spirit dance was unfolding. And people have said that he chose Number 9 Dream because he was hoping that that was a dream, because he knew he only had a few years left. When I was reading it, I was like, God, hold on. I've got a shiver down my spine if this is the case. I'm going to Mossley Hill, sell me guitar.
Well, I mean, yeah, I remember we talked about that number 9 But how does that also, too, I'm kind of just following your rundown here involving the Kray twins.
So getting back to actual curses, if you like. So there's a story that Brian Epstein, he had a voodoo curse put onto him by 60s East End gangsters, the Kray twins. Now, for those who don't know the Kray twins, I don't know how globally they're known, but they're very well known in the UK and certain other places. But they were a 60s gangster duo, really. Two brothers, twins, Ronnie and Reggie Kray. There was a film made of them. Spandau Ballet played both parts. It was actually a really good film, to be fair. But they were basically a pair of absolute rotters, to use an English term. But when the Beatles came to fruition, they obviously seen the money that was getting bandied about and the fame, and they approached Epstein and said, we want to manage the Beatles. Very bravely, Brian refused. And then they planned to out him like a blackmail plot. They planned to out him as being gay. But that fell through because he was kind of saying, well, I'm not bothered. You can do that if you wish. And so they went, right, we won't do that. So instead, Ronnie Kray turned to black magic, because apparently it was known in the East End that if they couldn't kill you through because you were in the public eye or whatever else, Ron had a series of curses that he could put on you. And he involved black magic, and some of them would be wrapping snakes around himself while he stomped and said curses. But he would tend to do it, and then the people would genuinely seem to die of ill health. And he genuinely believed that through black magic, he could defeat people. Not saying it worked personally, but as we know, Epstein then died of an overdose at just 32. So, you know, he died young, you know. So I'm not saying he was cursed, but...
Very.
It's arguably coincidental.
Especially with the Krays. Just rotters.
Just a pair of rotters, mate. That's all, yeah.
Have you ever heard the, before we move on to Fleetwood Mac, have you ever heard the Number of the Beast, Iron Maiden, strange things that happened when they made that record?
No.
So this is, it's not as crazy, but they had a lot of technical breakdowns during the making of the record. Lots of glitches and that sort of stuff. Electrical faults, equipment breaking down, as it says here, kind of similar to The Exorcist.
Wow.
But this is the best one of all, though. There's a couple little ones that this is the best one of all. So Martin Birch, who was the producer of the record, he was driving home from the studio after working on the title track, working on the Number of the Beast. And it was raining out and his car slid off the lane and hit a van.
Oh, my God.
He gets out of the car to go check out the van, and the van is filled with nuns. Yes. And then, similar to the story we just told, he takes, obviously, everyone's not hurt. Everybody's okay. And some dude that was driving the van begins to pray for Martin Birch, thanking God for sparing him for further harm. And then he takes the... He takes the car to the garage to get it fixed, and he gets the bill for how much it costs.
No.
And you can guess exactly how much it costs.
No way.
£666.
That's amazing.
And yes, and Martin, who just passed away a few months ago, apparently told the mechanic, like, I'm not paying that. You got to raise it to £668. This is, I don't want the piece of paper with the receipt saying that. So I bought a pack of gum or something. I got it to £667.
That's amazing. Like, anything more rock and roll than hitting a van full of nuns? That's just Iron Maiden and half.
After you were just producing the track Number of the Beast.
What a story. That's fantastic. I love that. I'm going to have to tell my partner that tonight.
So what else?
I'm going to move on to Fleetwood Mac. Now, this is an interesting one because it's... again, it's not that somebody put a curse on them. It's a series of things. Normally, it seems to center around the founder members of Fleetwood Mac, and it seems to be a bit more than coincidental. So as we know, Fleetwood Mac, amazing, amazing band, founded in 63 yes. by Peter Green and Mick Fleetwood. Now, for those who don't know, Peter Green died recently, and he's an outstanding, he's like one of my favorite guitarists / musicians of all time. Like, Abbey Road, Here Comes the Sun King.
Here Comes the Sun. Or Sun King.
The Sun King, off the, you know, Sun King, yeah.
Sun King, gotcha, yeah.
Apparently, that was the Beatles trying to write a song as good as Albatross by Peter Green. And when you listen to the two back-to-back, you can see what they were trying to do. It's he's just such an amazing musician. Anyway, we'll start with him, Peter Green. He was going into the drugs, which, as you'll see, is a lot, it ties into a lot of these tales. But drinking drugs became a little bit more prevalent. And he started to dabble in LSD a bit, but he was still compos mentis, still writing amazing music. They go on tour to Munich, and he gets in with these people who give him impure LSD. And by all accounts, they don't just like give him a tab of LSD. They pour the liquid LSD into his drink, by all accounts. And he never really comes back. He gets drug-induced schizophrenia. He doesn't cut his fingernails. He leaves the band. He gives all his money away. And he ends up like institutionalized. And that's him gone from the band. And he's, you know, he's the founding member. So that's him, you could argue. Well, he's, you know, he's had his fair share of bad luck there. One of the people who joined the band right. when Peter and Mick Fleetwood started, it was Jeremy Spencer, again, an original member. Now, he took some mescaline on a US tour. It all seems to do with mind-altering drugs as well, which is interesting. He took some mescaline mm-hmm. on a US tour. He started having premonitions about the rest of the tour, specifically the LA leg. And he was like very anxious about it and saying, I think we cut it out. I don't want to do it. We'll just skip LA. We'll move on to the next town. And on arrival, he says to Mick Fleetwood, I'm just going to buy a magazine when they check into the hotel. So Mick Fleetwood says, okay, Sam, see you later. And then he disappears. He's never seen again. He goes to, he joins apparently a religious cult and he's still in that cult today. He just walks out prior to the LA gig and he joins this religious cult.
That was it.
So that's another guitarist down. Then they had Danny Kirwan. And he was an amazing, very talented, joined them very young, I think about 17, maybe 18, amazing guitarist. And he slowly started to unravel. Again, drugs and drink played a huge part in it. And one day, again on a US tour, he's just tuning his guitar backstage. He has a full-on breakdown, starts laying into his guitar with his bare fists till his hands are cut open, flings his guitar across the room and walks out, stopping only to continuously headbutt a wall until someone has to pull him off and his head's pouring with blood. And then he spends the rest of that gig off stage in the crowd booing the band with blood. It's the ultimate trolling, isn't it? And then he certainly ended up homeless. And then the last one's very recently, Bob Welch, who then filled in, I think, for Danny Kirwan, or he was there around Danny Kirwan's time. He lost the use of his legs due to surgery. And he was told recently that he'd never walk again. And about, I think it was possibly this year at some point, he committed suicide, blew his brains out.
And then the last curse was Lindsey Buckingham getting kicked out of Fleetwood Mac because Stevie Nicks told everyone that he's her or him. So he got axed from that one too. So
yeah. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I was, although I preferred Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac, I was all right with that because I'm a big Neil Finn fan as well, and Neil Finn stepped in to replace him.
I saw that gig. He actually did really good. It was a good replacement.
He's great. Yeah, and they play some crowded out stuff as well. So if you ever see them, I'll get to see him there. Like, I did once see Velvet Revolver with Scott Weiland singing, and I was like, this is Guns N' Roses and Stone Temple Pilots. Exactly, this is amazing.
Exactly.
It's just that good. So yeah, sticking on with the music side of things, there's obviously another series of serendipity and coincidences which fit under a curse theme, allegedly, which is the Buddy Holly curse. Now, this seems to be, to me, more, not necessarily a curse, but more a lot of people who have had a lot of unfortunate circumstances who are associated with Buddy Holly, you know, as opposed to an actual curse that's been put on someone. And there's a list of these, you know, like we know that in 1959, February, his plane crashed, killing him, Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper. And they were all going on this rock and roll tour. But the guy who replaced him to go on that tour was a singer called Ronnie Smith. And he ended up hanging himself in a bathroom in 62. Eddie Cochran was due on that tour. And he always felt guilty that he couldn't make it. He felt like he cheated death. And then a year later, he had a car crash in the UK. And his last song was Three Steps to Heaven. And he was backed by the Crickets, which is a nice old Buddy Holly tie in there. That is a little bit weird. Like, there's quite a few. Like, the Crickets then got a new frontman called David Box. And then he tried for a solo career at 22. But at 22, the same age as Buddy Holly, he dies in a plane crash. So there's quite a lot of little weird things that go in. Like, there's a guy called Bob Fuller who loved Buddy Holly. And after Buddy Holly's death, he got to know Buddy Holly's parents. And they put him in touch with Buddy Holly's producer and got him a record deal. Now, he was found dead in his car the day after recording a cover of a Buddy Holly song, Love's Made a Fool of You. But they said it was suicide, but apparently he was beaten to a pulp and covered in gasoline, and he had a bit of a tie-in with the mob. But it was an officially a suicide, so they say. But there is quite a few. As well, like the guy who was a screenwriter, Robert Gitlow, who's a screenwriter on the Buddy Holly story, he committed suicide before the film was released. And the only other one that I could find tying into this was a guy called Lloyd Copus, who'd performed several times with Buddy Holly before his death. He died when the plane he was flying crashed near Nashville. Now, interestingly, on that plane was Patsy Cline. And she, in the lead up to that flight, had told several people that she knew she was going to die.
Hmm.
Not necessarily in a plane crash, but she'd said to several people like June Carter and people like that, I'm not coming back. Oh, you won't see me. This will be the last time you see me. Which isn't, you know, that's not a Buddy Holly curse, but it's tied in. They're all tied in some weird serendipitous way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing that a lot of this people feeling these premonitions that you're not going to see somebody again or you know, you're not going to see me around again. It seems to happen quite often.
Yeah, it is a weird one. Yeah, like as we said before, Roman Polanski had that overriding feeling. I mean, I've personally, touch wood, never ever seen someone and thought, don't think I'm going to see you again. And right. I never do want to feel that because I think it'd drive me absolutely mad. But yeah, so that's the Buddy Holly section, really. To be honest with you, Chris, I could have, with the amount that people do attribute to the Buddy Holly curse, you could do a full hour, but it's not worth it because I guarantee you, you end up saying things like, and then his pet gopher jumped out of a window, and you're like, well, that's nothing to do with it, you know, but people have said, no, it is.
Well, let's talk about the Hungarian suicide song.
This is cool. I say cool. But, you know.
Eerie.
And this
creepy,
is one of the ones you do. You need. It is eerie and creepy, yeah, but in a cool way. But obviously a very touchy subject as well. So there's a song called Gloomy Sunday, and it's known as the Hungarian suicide song. Now, it was first written by a Hungarian pianist called Rezo Serez in 1933. And it was originally entitled The World is Ending. And he wrote this melancholy lament about war and about the frivolity, and not the frivolity, sorry, the absolute banality of war. And the final bit was a prayer about the horrors which man has brought into the world. Now, the English version with the lyrics as we now know them was first done by Hal Kemp in 1936 and gave it its name that we call it today, Gloomy Sunday. But why it's known as the Hungarian suicide song is down to some very eerie things that took place when it was first released. So on its original release in Hungary, the song's climb in popularity seemed to coincide with a rise in suicides in Hungary. Now, people looked at those two figures and were like, right, is that just coincidence? But then, whether it be anecdotally or not, there were stories about people having the door broken down, and when you'd go in, they'd be hanging from the light bulb and Gloomy Sunday would be on the record player. Like they'd just listen to it and then top themselves. So people surmised that one led to the other, really. And then the story hit the headlines and the press got hold of it and it blew up everywhere. And there were cases of people, as I say, you know, someone would be dead in the living room and there'd be record would either be smashed or it'd be playing continuously. And it went all over Europe, this story. And eventually Hungary banned the song from being broadcast because they were that fearful of whether it was down to an actual curse of a suicide song or it was people going crazy like they do tend to when things get in the press. They banned it from being played. And that kind of hysteria made its way to England. And the BBC read the same story. And instantly, they put a ban on Gloomy Sunday being played on by any BBC outlet. And they only lifted that ban in 2002.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Like 80 years later or 70 years later, whatever, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. I don't know whether it's because they looked and went, oh Christ, that's still on there. That's silly, let's get rid of it. Or whether they were like, no, it's now safe to do so.
Isn't it something to do with the tritones too? Like the song Black Sabbath, that bow, bow, bow. Like that was some kind of evil thing back in the day.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, to be honest, I didn't look into necessarily the composition of it, but I would not be surprised. Now, interestingly, Serez, the guy who wrote the song, added to this whole myth of the song because he did come out and say that, firstly, he said he confessed that the song was originally written in memory of his girlfriend who had committed suicide. And then after divulging that, he tried to throw himself out of a window but survived and then strangled himself to death with copper wire. So it's added to the mythos that embedded within this song is this thing that can absolutely take you to the low depths of desperation. So much so that Billie Holiday actually recorded a version for the US market. And again, it spread like wildfire throughout all the little territories and states that, you know, just listening to it, there's a chance you're going to kill yourself after you've listened to it. And it will bring on a series of negative thoughts. And several states, although it wasn't blanket banned in the US, several individual states did ban the song from being played unofficially, worried because that version may set people off. Now, as a side note, this is on Spotify. So, you know, people should listen to it. Listen to it at the peril, but it is on there.
Just talking about the tritone, that is those chords of that Black Sabbath plays, or it's the beginning of YYZ as well, the beginning of Purple Haze, those chords. It said, in the Middle Ages, composers and singers were forbidden from using flatted fifths, which is what the tritone is, because of the dissonant demonic tone it creates. It was called Diabolus in Musica.
Oh, wow.
It was born in that era, since high clergymen found the tone to be the antithesis of godliness. There's no evidence that the technique was ever officially banned, but it was distasteful to the church, so no one dared to integrate it into their music until the evil Black Sabbath. There you go.
Amazing.
Yeah. But speaking of cursed songs, Crossroads, the famous Robert Johnson song, also has a lot of negativity surrounding it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everybody, again, most people know the story of Robert Johnson in terms of the guy who sold his soul to the devil, handed the devil his guitar, the devil tuned it up, passed him it back, and the next day he walks into a nightclub and plays like Slash, and the blues equivalent of Slash. So that's Robert Johnson. But he also obviously he wrote a song called Crossroads. And not only is it meant to be Robert Johnson, who cares, but it's meant to be the song Crossroads itself. And performing it can allegedly curse you as the performer with the same sort of fate that Robert Johnson met, i.e. the devil will come and try and get you. Now, Eric Clapton and his band Cream recorded it on Wheels of Fire, one of their albums. Now, soon after the band collapsed, Clapton became a heavy heroin addict. Now, some other people have said, you know, well, later on, don't forget, he got clean and his son then died from falling from a window. And I'm a bit like, yeah, but if he's fought the thing that was like the heroin, which is meant to be the thing that was meant to have been the curse, then I don't want to say they're related, but it's still not bloody nice at the end of the day,
right?
Obviously.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, it's horrific, isn't it? It's horrific. But I mean, then there's the Allman Brothers as well. Like Duane Allman of the Allman Brothers performed that song, Crossroads, many times as like a thank you to the crowds that they play for. And he was killed in a motorcycle accident trying to avoid a truck. Now, a year later, the guitarist,
bass player,
Barry Oakley, I think his name is, who would support him. Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, he would support him when he'd do those performances. He died in a motorcycle accident at the exact same location.
Unbelievable. Later, yeah. Same location and basically the same way.
Exactly. Yeah. And then there's like apparently Lynyrd Skynyrd would play it too. And then, of course, they had the plane crash.
Wow.
So I don't know. You know, again, get out that massive bag of salt.
Well, yeah. And Skynyrd has a whole shitload too. That's a whole other show. Not just the crash, but there's subsequent years afterwards. So, you know, like you said, if that started with Robert Johnson selling his soul to the devil, I would say anybody listening, don't cover Crossroads. And don't listen to Gloomy Sunday.
Yeah, we've just absolutely decimated Robert Johnson's Spotify rank takings there, haven't we, really?
Another curse song is Without You, which I believe is a Harry Nilsson song.
Yeah, well, this is it. The Without You is arguably, when you Google curse songs, that'll be the first thing that pops up. It was originally written, actually, by a Liverpudlian and a Welshman.
Yeah.
From Badfinger, the band that the Beatles signed to Apple. And it was the Liverpool guy was Tom Evans and the Welshman was Peter Ham. Now, they basically got into bad financial advice when Harry Nilsson got hold of the song and made it the song that we all know because he made it popular. They got a load of royalties off that, but they didn't get a penny of it. And Peter Ham, due to this, hung himself in his garage, quoting the financial advisor. I can't remember what the guy's name was, but he said he'd take him to hell with him. Now, a few years later, Tom Evans, he hung himself in his garden due to the same situation. Like they both entered financial ruin because they just got bad advice throughout their careers, which is obviously horrible. So there's the two writers of the song gone. Then Nilsson records it. He gets a huge hit. Can't really handle the level of fame he's being catapulted into. Although he was semi-famous prior, but he obviously then becomes a craven drug addict. Alcoholic. With the money from the song, which we touched on with the Paranormal Beatles episode, he buys a flat in London, 12 Curzon Place, and he rents it out to famous people, two people being Mama Cass, who dies in that flat, and Peter Moon, who has an overdose in the flat years later. So anything he seems to try and do with that revenue from the song seems to be cursed. as well as anyone attached to the song, mm-hmm. because then in later years we have Mariah Carey who done a version of it, and allegedly after recording it, her mental health suffered and she ended up sectioned. So again, it's just, and it, you know what is a weird thing with Without You? Before I was even into I had access to Google, and talking like as like a 14-year-old kid, I would put on Without You, the Harry Nilsson version, and there is something within that song, I've always thought it, which does grab something within you that, I don't know, it's got the ability to drag you to a low place, that song. It's really eerie. So I don't know, if you're performing it night in, night out, maybe it does have a culminative effect.
Sure, absolutely. You said that's the flat that he owned is the same one where Mama Cass and Keith Moon died in, Harry Nilsson's flat, like you said. So yeah, man. Well, as we start to wind down, there's a few more here. I mean, where do you want to go to? There's a couple great ones left.
Well, I thought what we could talk about, there's a really interesting one is a guy. And now this, again, it's not really a case. It's just very interesting. There's a guy called Jim Sullivan, and he's like a folk musician, or he was a folk musician, should I say. Now, interestingly, his parents were Irish American, and they moved from Nebraska, I think, to California initially, and they worked in defense. They were like working in military defense, and he, in his songwriting career, had a very heavy fixation on UFOs and aliens. And I always think that it might be due to something that he's seen due to his parents being in defense. I don't know. That's probably stretching it a bit too far. But anyway, one of his albums that he released in 69 was called UFO, and it's all about meeting UFOs and all this carry on. Anyway, his career takes a bit of a swan dive, and he decides in 1975 that he's going to drive to Nashville to meet one of his friends over there from LA, jump in his Beetle that he's got, his VW Beetle. He's going to drive to Nashville. All he takes is a load of money, his guitar, some records to sell while he's down there, and some clothes, and just drive down to Nashville. Anyway, he never arrives in Nashville, and his car's found in Santa Rosa, New Mexico. It's still got all of his money in it, so it's not a robbery. He's still got his guitar in it, his clothes, and all of the records. The car door's left open, and he's in the middle, basically, of this, for want of a better phrase, kind of little village desert. And he's never been seen since. No record of him's been found. The theory is he was abducted, and that all through his life, he knew what he was talking about, sort of thing. Just a lovely little... When I say lovely, you know, you've got to always remember that somebody has gone missing and they've got a family.
Well, yeah, of course. It's a very juicy story for sure, you know.
It is, yeah.
Was it the guy from maybe Iron Butterfly that was looking into time travel and then same thing, just disappeared? Have you heard that one before?
No, that's amazing.
Let me do some Googling on this. but once again, yeah, you get these weird, weird stories in rock and roll, which, you know, once again, surrounded by so many weird people. But here it is. Yeah, the Philip Taylor Kramer was in Iron Butterfly.
Yeah.
And he created Total Multimedia Inc., a company that did pioneering work in video compression technology. And he made a 911 call saying he was going to kill himself. And that's the last anybody ever heard from him. But it was if he had simply vanished into thin air. Something happened to him in his head or in the terminal. They found his van spotted at the bottom of a Malibu ravine by hikers in a canyon and ruled a possible suicide, but they never found him. And he had been working on a revolutionary method of transporting information and matter through space. His father remained unconvinced his death was a suicide. Taylor told me a long time before there were people giving him problems. They wanted the technology. Several of them had threatened him. He said, if I ever say I'm going to kill myself, don't believe it. I'm going to be needing help. So there you go.
I love that. What you do? Well, I'm in Iron Butterfly. I've never heard of you. Oh, well, maybe you've heard of my time machine.
Exactly.
Amazing.
So, fantastic. Yeah, there you go. Once again, time machines and alien abductions and all this other stuff. Yeah, I mean, once again, rock and roll is such a strange collection of characters as it is. That all of these stories, like you said, take them with a grain of sugar, a grain of salt, but it sure makes it interesting. You know, like we would never be talking about Jim Sullivan.
No,
if he hadn't possibly been abducted by a UFO.
Well, this is it. I know I've listened to that UFO album and it's quite good. It's like Tim Hardin in places. It's relatively decent, but I would never have listened to that album if not for being interested in UFOs. And I'm sure that wherever he is, God rest his soul, or if he's in space, I don't know. But, you know, I'm sure that like, I don't know whether he'd be pleased or not about that. If it's like, no, you should listen to my music because I'm great, yeah, not because you think I'm on Venus.
Let's tell one more story about the curse of Bone Thugs and Harmony.
So Bone Thugs and Harmony is an interesting one. So it's not a long one, if I'm being perfectly honest. Yeah, it's just a little addendum. But it ties in. I got this actually from a very strange website, so this needs the whole bag of salt. But basically, do you recall Bone Thugs and Harmony had a song called Crossroads, which was meet you at the crossroads, meet you at the crossroads sort of thing. I mean, and it sounds just like that. It's that good. But the guy who was putting through a lot of the Crossroads things that didn't make any sense about it being cursed, he was saying that there's an argument that Bone Thugs and Harmony, they have a song called Crossroads, albeit not the Robert Johnson version, but they apparently used a Ouija board at the start of their career to divine or as divination to see if they'd be successful. And they took some of the decisions based on like what this Ouija board said, you know, like they'd ask, like, should we go to this particular record producer meeting? And it'd be like, yeah, you should go. Right, we're going because the Ouija board said we're going. So when you hear things like that, you know, I'm not surprised that they're not still out in the charts now, to be honest.
I think if nothing else, we've now discerned that you need to do a cover of Bone Thugs and Harmony Crossroads.
Yeah,
definitely. Kevin, it's always a blast talking to you, man. And you keep coming up with these amazing tidbits and stories. And I'm sure you'll be back on when you come up with something else.
Oh, that's great. Thanks again for having me on, Chris.
You're a Halloween tradition here on Talk is Jericho. So you got
I like it.
You got a year to come up with something else.
Oh, I'll do it. Don't worry.
Cheers, man. Thanks, dude.
Thanks, Chris. See you now.